Coleman.
The first case for this morning is Trade Finance Partners versus AAR Corporation. Mr. Curry.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is John Curry, representing the plaintiff, Trade Finance Partner. In entering summary judgment against my client, Trade Finance, the District Court misconstrued plaintiff Trade Finance's breach of contract claim. Trade Finance claims, under its strategic trade agreement with AAR Allen, that Allen, in December 2004, identified and designated Northwest Airlines as a target account, specifically to win the bid for long-term hydraulic, pneumatic, and avionic maintenance, repair, and overhaul work, otherwise known as MRO work. The trade agreement provides at Section 6.3, Trade Finance shall pursue targeted opportunities through sales calls, presentations, demonstrations, and any other means elected by the parties.
Mr. Curry, there was never anything in writing, was there, indicating that Northwest was a designated account?
The writing would be reflected in the exchange of emails between Mr. Brunsma and Cal Cooper, the managing director of Trade Finance, and also emails between Cooper and Frank Boney, who was the vice president of sales.
But that wasn't the type of writing that the contract called for.
Well, the contract at Section 1 says that a target account can be designated either in writing or orally between the parties to be wrapped up by a later,
reflected in a later writing.
That is correct.
Firm. And the whole point of contractual provisions like that in situations like this is to avoid precisely this kind of dispute where it's not clear whether a company's efforts to procure business were under the agreement or not.
That would be correct, but that's where the duty of good faith and fair dealing comes into play. The contract did specifically in writing say that a target account could be orally designated.
If it was later confirmed,
yes.
But it never was.
And on February 1st, 2005, as is clear in the record, there was a meeting at AAR Allen between Trade Finance, Cooper being present, and Brunsma and Boney of AAR Allen. And Brunsma and Boney promised to Cooper that they would complete the RFI. They asked, and this is at Section 43 of Cooper's declaration, that they had asked, well, give us some more time. We want to wait to see if a subsequent request for proposal comes through from Northwest. Once we have that, we will complete the RFI. So they specifically promised, and at that point they triggered a duty to do what they said they would do. And by their failure to do that, and again, it's our theory that AAR Allen was pleased to string Trade Finance along and have them do the work that benefited them without commensurately following through with their obligation under Section 1 to follow up with completing a request for information, or RFI, once they orally designated it.
District Court, though, didn't think in the end that there was any evidence that anything that TFP did had any effect on Northwest.
Well, I think this is where I think this is where the District Court misconstrued the argument of Trade Finance and what our claim is about. Our claim is that the target account was designated, that we were requested by Northwest to pursue particular activity to enhance their bid for this MRO work, and under Section 6.3 of the Strategic Trade Agreement, that's contemplated, that Trade Finance could do the work that would be directed by its client, AAR Allen, to procure that. They engaged in the work, and that's clear in the record that, you know, communications were made, letters were sent, meetings were set up. Reitlinger admits to the meetings. Reitlinger admits to explaining to Cooper how AAR Allen had fallen short in prior long-term contracts to be arranged. And at that point, in February 1st, AAR Allen promised to complete this RFI. And
but
what
they never did it, though. I mean, you know, there is never.
Well, that's correct. It's our claim is that that was their duty at that point to complete
what?
That.
I
because they had orally promised it in the meeting of February 1st, 2005, as is clear in section, rather paragraph 43 of Cooper's declaration.
Is there any evidence about negotiations over the terms of this RFI, and in particular over the percentage of profits that would be placed in this business development fund, which seems to be the method of payment over and above the retainer, the flat retainer that the contract provided for?
Yes. Again, this the focus on it started at the February 1st meeting in which Cooper asked, you know, I think we should wrap up the RFI now, and A.R. Allen said, no, we need more time. And subsequently, there were emails, which would be, forgive me, but I can provide that to you. I believe that would be in exhibits. The exhibits, by the way, were uniformly numbered. So through all the depositions, the same exhibit number applied to items. Exhibits between 24 and 60, there were a series of emails that Cooper had sent to A.E.R. Allen between February and April 22nd, inquiring when are we going to complete this RFI, when are we going to finish it.
But these are the emails that the district court thought had hearsay problems.
That's not correct, not the emails running between Cooper and its
client. Well, there's a February 9th email from Cooper to a number of people, Frank Boney, Rob Brinsma, copy to Robert Washburn, that you've been relying on, that the district court said, at least for the truth of the matter about whether inventory's been identified and so on, was hearsay.
Well, I think this is where it's off focus. That's what the district court wanted to rely on. But what our case is that we performed the work that A.R. Allen asked us to do, then refused to complete the RFI. Now, the February 9th email is evidence of us doing the work. In other words, non-hearsay. It reflects the fact that Trade Finance was complying with the contractual request of of A.R. Allen to engage with Northwest to advance the MRO bid.
I just don't know where your evidence is that there is that predicate request, though.
It's Cooper's testimony, which is clear in paragraph 43 of his declaration.
But Mr. Johnson on January 13 says, I'm not interested in anything. I don't agree that AAR's pricing is competitive and so on.
Well, again, he was only one actor in the entire format. It's clear in the record, in the reports of Cooper after February 1st, 2005, that they were getting some movement in talking with Craig Reitlinger, and that was his report to A.R. Allen. And, in fact, Reitlinger in his deposition admits that he had two meetings after that Johnson declaration that he was not interested. Reitlinger had two more meetings with Trade Finance Partners in February before February 9th. Reitlinger admits that he explained how A.A.R. Allen before had fallen short in applying for this MRO work, complying with the Northwest bid process.
Are you sure? Is this what part of the part that's unclear about whether it's landing gear or the other broader?
That's a red herring. The landing gear contract was closed out.
I know.
On January 3rd, Cooper wrote a letter saying, we want to offer on behalf of our client landing gear services, avionics, pneumatics, and hydraulics. So Johnson sends an email back later saying, well, the landing gear contract is closed. And this is what's key and where there's a misinterpretation. He goes on to say in response to Trade Finance's offer about pneumatics, hydraulics, and avionics that I don't agree that AAR's pricing is competitive. We have not been able to reach an agreement with AAR on several projects for a number of reasons. Well, it doesn't make sense that he would go on and comment about that after, you know, if it's only related to the landing gear kind of. That's just completely inconsistent.
But you didn't introduce any hard, aside from that inference that you don't think you can read this way, there's no evidence in this record that actually shows an email saying, we are now having a conversation about avionics, pneumatics, and hydraulics. You're just drawing this inference from context.
Well, the testimony would be Cooper's testimony. And that becomes an issue of fact. Who does a jury want to believe? Cooper's testimony of what his conversations with Reitlinger were about, or Johnson's testimony? In fact, Johnson was not part of the meetings between Cooper and Reitlinger.
Well, even assuming, counsel, all of the favorable inferences about the email exchanges run in your favor, the contract requires for your client to be paid out of this business development fund that your client secure the target account's written commitment for the purchase from client of products and or services. And that never occurred. Your client didn't secure Northwest's written commitment or any other contractual arrangement. There were several contacts, and that's about it.
Well, you have to understand how the process would work.
I'm just reading the contract language. Then the contract requires, as a condition precedent to your client getting paid out of the business development fund, which it seems to me this dispute is about, because the retainer was paid and kept.
Yes.
Right? So we're talking about the percentage of the profits which were supposed to be paid into this business development fund, even assuming your good faith breach claim would succeed, and even assuming all the inferences in your favor about these emails, your client didn't secure this account the defendant.
Yes,
here.
I want to answer your question. I don't mean to interrupt. But in answer to your earlier question, Exhibit 65 is the RFI form that Trade Finance was finally forced to put together on its own to put under A.R. Allen's nose. They can't seal any deal with Northwest until they have the RFI completed by their client, because that document defines the scope of how much they're permitted to sell. In other words, if Trade Finance were to do exactly what you suggested, craft a separate deal with Northwest, and that would, say, include a commitment to buy $50 million of excess assets from Northwest, and then they didn't have the RFI, and then they went to A.R. Allen and said, well, let's complete this RFI. They said, oh, no, we're not going to authorize $50 million. We're going to authorize only $10 million. So Trade Finance would be on the hook for some $40 million, which is just outside the scope of what the entire or how the agreement is to work. The agreement is to work whereby Trade Finance brings value to both of these contracting parties. And they're able to do that by purchasing underused assets or equivalent assets,
right,
you know,
but that
has to be defined by their client. A.R. Allen has to give them the permission and the scope of where they're going to go, because A.R. Allen is essentially going to fund what their earnings are going to be at the end of the day. So that's why the RFI was so important, and why they couldn't conclude a deal with Northwest. Not only that, the April 22nd email. If you look at the range of the declaration by Cooper between paragraphs 45 and 80, and at the April emails, Cooper got to a point where he had a rough proposal from Northwest, and he transmitted that to Boney, and Boney evaded the issue. Boney at A.R. Allen said, well, we can't even see how this is going to shift any business our way. Don't go ahead and discuss this any further with the finance department of Northwest Airlines. So at each step of the way, even looking at your perspective that, well, gee, what if they just got a deal with Northwest, A.R. Allen hampered them from concluding that type of deal. Thank you.
Correct. Mr. Stuckey?
May it please Your Honors, Hans Stuckey on behalf of the Appley AAR, AAR Corp and AAR Allen. AAR Allen is the signatory to this agreement, which was entered into in January of 2005. And I want to turn immediately to one of the issues that Mr. Curry raised on behalf of TFP, and that is as to whether Mr. Reidlinger was a decision maker. The fact is, the only decision maker as applied to this particular contract was Mr. Johnson. And that is, it's in, I believe, our Rule 56.1 statement at paragraph 60, 67. Now, there was some discussion in Mr. Reidlinger's deposition about the extent of his authority, and at page 66 of his deposition, Mr. Reidlinger testified that he had some authority to recommend as to the landing gear project, which was an entirely different project and was unrelated to this particular undertaking by AAR and TFP. So as to that, he allowed that he had some influence, but he was not even there. He didn't say he was the decision maker. The TFP cites to paragraphs 45 through 47 of Mr. Cooper's declaration as evidence of the fact that Mr. Reidlinger was a decision maker as to this MRO contract, and that is simply not found in paragraphs 45 through 47. In fact, in those paragraphs, not a 56.1 statement, but in the paragraphs of his affidavit or his declaration, all that's referred to there is that Mr. Reidlinger was a management employee of Northwest Airlines and that Mr. Cooper had discussed with him past issues. There were no facts alleged that he was the decision maker. Page 81 of Mr. Reidlinger's deposition states only that he was a part of the review process for AAR's bid on this MRO contract, and why they call it MRO when it's pneumatic and hydraulic, I don't know. But he was a part of the review process. It does not stay. It does not state, as alleged by TFP, that the exact role that he played or that he in fact had any decision-making authority. The person who did have decision-making authority was Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, as evidenced by the January 13th email, which is a part of the discussion in the briefing here, had determined early on that this was not this approach. He testified that he had seen this approach before, where you buy assets from one company in exchange for credits to be used in against another vendor, and he had seen that approach before and not been impressed by it. And he says, in fact, in that email, unless there's something else you have, I'm not going to be interested in it. And in fact, he testified in his deposition that he had no interest. He did not see that it brought value to Northwest Airlines because, as he said, he was always able to find by way of discount, which was real money as opposed to credits, he was always able to find by way of discount sufficient money that he didn't have to engage in the transfer or the exchange of credits.
Let me ask you a question, because yes. It seems to me one thing that might have led to this dispute is the following. TFP is out there, and they are making some efforts to bring AAR and Northwest Airline together based on their business model that you just described, this model of finding underused assets and trying to create these trade credits and the like. And Mr. Johnson appears to say in this January 13 memo that he doesn't like that model, basically, that he'd rather go just the straightforward discount model. He says something, I don't think it's in this memo, but somewhere in the record, they say something like, we have our RFP out there, they need to just follow the process that we have outlined, and so forth. So what if, though, Trade Finance Partners' efforts to bring them together actually helped Northwest and AAR enter into an ordinary discount kind of agreement? Is that possible? Because it seems to me TFP is saying, well, we helped to facilitate the visit to the premises. We helped to facilitate
those a couple of things. First, that wasn't the nature of this agreement. That agreement did not provide for compensation under those circumstances.
So the agreement was quite precise. It had to be this special business model.
That was the business that they were in, yes. That's the business that TFP is in. That's the only way TFP did business, so far as we were aware. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that the contract provides that they essentially secure new business, that they secure new business from customers for AAR in this case. And it, throughout the history of this matter, the plaintiff or the appellant here, TFP, has claimed that they encountered what they call a secret barrier to AAR receiving any on Northwest's part to awarding any further work to AAR, and that they overcame that secret barrier. They reversed it, and that's why the agreement, by way of open lines of communication and by way of arranging a site visit, that's how they are entitled to some recovery in this matter. In fact, in their opening brief in this matter, they indicated that the information that Johnson provided to TFP on January 13, 2005 was significant in that it communicated to TFP that NWA believed that AAR's pricing was out of line in NWA's needs and that an undisclosed reason operated as a barrier to any further contracts awarded to AAR.
Right. Now, I understand that, too, because I guess the timing was that Northwest had already, back a few months earlier, put out the RFP and AAR had submitted a bid and it wasn't really going anywhere. And then time goes on, and at some point later, eventually in June, right, something like that.
Yeah.
The agreement.
Actually, the sequence of it is that I think the bids were due in October of 2004. There was a period of non-activity. Then there was actually a phase two to the same contract that was issued on February 1 before this conversation that TFP supposedly had about all the problems with the prior problems with AAR. And then the contract itself was awarded in June, so you're correct about that. But now it appears that the position that TFP takes is that all they did was open up the lines of communication, and that along with arranging for the site visit was appropriate. Now, let's assume for the moment that would be appropriate. It is not under the agreement. They must secure new business. They can't just make people friendly and benefit as a result of that where they were friendly in the first place. There are a couple of problems. First of all, Mr. Johnson testified that there were really no problems with communications. In fact, Northwest was doing business and had done business with AAR for any number of years. With Garden City, a New York facility, this very facility that had this bid pending. The second problem is, as to the site visit, Mr. Reidlinger, whom counsel deposed on this issue of site visit, was not asked by counsel. No evidence related to the significance of the site visit that was asked about. There was no indication as to whether Northwest did site visits in all such cases. And, in fact, Mr. Reidlinger in his testimony stated that they do this as a part of their regular process, so it wasn't anything out of the ordinary. Counsel did not ask what happened during the site visit. He did not ask what was learned on the site visit that was relevant to the issues that were before Northwest at that point. And he did not ask whether the visit had any impact on the decision to award the contract to AAR or not. So to take the position that you opened lines of communication in the face of the testimony of the decision maker that there were no problems in that regard, and then to claim that a site visit that you claim to have arranged could have, those are the words in the brief, could have arranged for this situation to occur without having probed the very witness upon whom you rely for that site visit on those critical questions does not, we think, establish a basis for recovery, even under that lowered standard. I might just say that the district court here focused on what we think, and we think this court should focus on, the issue of causation. That's what the strategic trade agreement focuses on. It requires that TFP undertake activity to secure new business, and that was not done in this case. Instead, what TFP tries to convince the court is that those emails and those comments by Mr. Reidlinger and by Mr. Johnson in his deposition don't really mean what they seem to say if you consider them in the context of a larger picture. And that context includes documents like the January 3rd, 2005 email, January 11th, 2005 email, neither of which were cited to the district court on this matter. And which have hearsay problems. Certainly the January 11th one does. The January 3rd one wasn't even mentioned. So what counsel is seeking to do on behalf of his client here is berate the trial court for not deciding issues in TFP's favor, which were not raised on behalf of TFP. This gets to the issue of waiver, and on the issue of waiver, as to Mr. Johnson, waiver in terms of admissibility of evidence, arguments that are made in terms of admissibility of evidence. As to Mr. Johnson, of course, arguments are made that the January 11th email, January 11 and January 13, it's actually an email trail, should be admitted. And in fact, the district court said, well, to the extent that it is not admitted for the truth of the matter, I guess it could show that there were communications as between the two of them, which is a requirement of the contract. But the difficulty is that appellant does not appear to understand that while something may be admissible on one basis, that does not make it admissible for all purposes. It does not make it admissible for purposes of the truth of the matter. And if you look at the argument that is presented, all of the context that is provided, which purportedly conflicts with or misconstrues the plain language of the other emails and testimony, all of that is provided by way of documents which were not introduced, or documents which you must assume the truth of in order to create this conflict or in order to create this inconsistency.
I think one of the reasons that we're having problems, though, or that there are some problems, is that the district court's rulings are not as clear as they might be. I mean, the district court, in some instances, comes up to the brink of saying, you know, yes, this is hearsay, or this particular thing is admissible for purpose A but not for the truth, or whatever. But the district court never quite crosses over that threshold, and so it's making it a little bit difficult to see where to stand.
I understand that, actually. I think in particular the document that we were just talking about, that email January 11 and January 13, the court doesn't say it's not admissible as hearsay. It says it may be admissible if it's only offered for this purpose. So we think that means that it's not admissible for purposes of showing the truth of the matter. But it's I concede, frankly, that there is some lack of clarity there. I don't think there's any similar
and
lack.
It would have been in your interest to sharpen that up, just to say, you know, could we just get a ruling on what it's in for and what it isn't in for? Because then that would put everyone in a position, with the appellants and you, to know exactly what evidence could be used and for what.
Ultimately, of course, the clincher on that, insofar as AAR was concerned, is the argument that we've attempted to make here today, which the district court found, and that is, even if these things are allowed in, they do not conflict. They are not internally inconsistent. They do not contradict one another unless and until you allow context of the type that is now being used in the briefs, and that context is improper for the reasons stated. So we would urge that the district court was correct as to the contract claims. Certainly there are fraud claims as well, and as with any type of claim, there must be damages to be shown, and I think Your Honors have highlighted to some extent the fact that the record is relatively undisputed that no work ever came as a result of TFP's efforts, if you listen to the person who made the decision, who is an independent person, is not an AAR person, it's a person who worked for Northwest Airlines. And that being the case, we think the judge correctly ruled in favor of AAR and would ask this court to affirm that decision. Do you have any other questions?
No. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Curry.
You.
Mr. Curry, how much time? Yeah. You have 7 minutes, Mr. Curry.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me get right to counsel's last point. Which I think is not made absolutely undisputable on the record, and that is Johnson is the only voice that mattered in this contract. For one thing, I believe it's Exhibit 33, which is the actual pneumatic and hydraulic MRO contract. Let's dispense of nomenclature because the parties here constantly refer to pneumatic and hydraulic contract as MRO work. But regardless, this pneumatic hydraulic...
Do you know what that stands for?
Yes, for maintenance, repair, and overhaul. It means a long-term work for, as I said in my opening argument, but it's long-term work. That Johnson was not the signatory of that contract. It was the vice president of the company that signed the contract. And the facts are that Reitlinger was part of the process of making this decision. And this attempt at minimizing that doesn't exclude that fact. Reitlinger was the one that did the site visit. Johnson made it clear that, you know, within his department that, you know, he had concerns. But he then thereafter referred trade finance to the finance department of the company. Now, how is it if you are a one department manager and you refer the matter for further discussion to a corporate officer for further work, how is that cutting off dealing with or negotiating with trade finance as a positive factor in eventually awarding this bid?
Well, but I would ask you, I mean, it seems to me it's the most common of events within corporations or any organization that the final decision maker obtains input from various other people. It doesn't mean that he has ceded his decision-making authority, but he gets information from finance people, he gets information from technical people, he gets information from whoever he wants information from.
Well,
he's still the decision maker.
Well, again, he is a decision maker, and it does.
Isn't he the final decision maker on this?
There's no evidence of that in the record. All he was asked was, as far as you were concerned, did you feel that trade finance somehow enabled this contract? And he said no. I think you have to look at that very narrowly.
The contract doesn't follow the trade finance business model. It's not an underused assets, well, trade credits, et cetera.
Well, see, this is where all of that occurred outside the knowledge of trade finance. Trade finance was foreclosed from any material information about the contract process after mid-February 2005.
But why
and this is where the good
right
faith is.
Leverage a few emails into a portion of this development fund that Judge Sykes was mentioning?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand
that. Well, there are a couple of emails, and they're told, we don't like your business plan, and then maybe they're starting to overcome some resistance on Northwest's part, and then they basically vanish from the scene. And I'm just curious as to why those minor efforts translate into such a significant contribution to this contract that they should get paid for it.
Right. Well, I think that's a... You have to look at the language of that email, and again is, I don't agree that AAR's pricing is competitive. There's nothing in the Johnson email that says, I don't like Trade Finance Partners' proposal for us. Now, he suggested something of that sort in his deposition, but I think we're entitled to look at this evidence of the email he sent. In other words, what is true? What he said in the email. Or once he has this lucrative contract signed with AAR Allen, which he, as a manager, doesn't want to see disturbed as a course of some litigation, he shades in his deposition testimony a year and a half later or so.
That's reading a lot into this. I'm looking at the email, and it's reading an awful lot into it. He could think that the pricing under the TFP model isn't correct, but just a straightforward discount does work.
He doesn't say that, though. He says AAR and makes absolutely no reference to trade finance.
He says, I don't agree that AAR's pricing is competitive. He says this on January the 13th, and some months later, the parties come to an agreement based on a conventional business model.
Right. Well, this is where the good faith and fair dealing aspect comes in. AAR affirmatively interfered with Trade Finance Partners' involvement in this matter. It refused to complete the RFI. It did not disclose material information. Council made reference to the site visit. We didn't even know that the site visit took form until after discovery closed in this case. After discovery closed, AAR Allen produced some financial documentation which had been long requested, and embedded in this 5,000 pages of financial information, embedded in it were emails that we had requested many months before. And one of those emails is an email from Reidlinger to Boney inquiring about setting up the site visit, and that email went out the exact same hour that Cal Cooper of Trade Finance had the conversation with Reidlinger about setting up the site visit. So this information was information we first found in discovery in this case. In fact, some of it came in after discovery was closed. So AAR Allen was not forthcoming. It blocked Trade Finance between mid-February and June 2005, when the MRO contract was executed, from them getting information. Under the trade agreement, they're supposed to be cooperating partners, working jointly.
But, of course, you didn't really have any opportunity costs either because of this contract. You were free to work for whatever other clients you had since you weren't working.
Not in this industry. There was an exclusivity clause, so we could not work for other aircraft companies. It was exclusive in terms of aircraft components to AAR Allen. And, there were visits, as is clear in the record, to Minneapolis from New York.
But only for the designated accounts. And if Northwest wasn't a designated account ever, you never got that final paperwork.
Again, going back to one, you can orally designate, and there's some issue of timeliness. The client wants us to do the work. They want to get that project. They don't want someone else to win the bid. So in terms of whether they're going to attend to the internal paperwork, which they would have an obligation to do based on what they're asking Trade Finance Partners to do to undertake the work immediately, understand that Trade Finance engaged in this, identified itself to Northwest as working for A.R. Allen on or about June 11th, and then it was about a month and a half. Thank you very much, Ron.
Thank you. Sure. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.